Srila Prabhupada Ki, Sri Bhakti Vaibhava Ki, Jai Grantaraj, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Jai Giri Raj Maharaj, Jaya Nitai Gopremana. So what do we discuss? Last night. And then your good qualities will increase. Yeah. And if you negate others, then your negative qualities will increase. Any other points?
When any pure devotee criticizes, either we have to close our ears, or else if we are powerful enough, strong enough to fight, we can cut the tongue of the person, kill them.
Sounds good, but it may not be practical. Any other points? Any other points? Yeah, it's not jihad, because jihad means you kill other people as well. Self-combustion. Suicide. Any other points? Very important. Any other thoughts? So chapter one is called? The genealogical table of the descendants of Manu. So we hear of the three daughters, Devahuti, Akuti, and Prasuti. Now, Prasuti had many children. One of her daughters was Sati. Sati married Lord Shiva. Chapter 2 is called? Actually, curses Lord Shiva. Mm-hmm. So Daksha, when he entered the sacrificial arena, then everyone in the assembly stood up and offered obeisances, respect to him, except Lord Brahma, who was his father, and Lord Shiva, who was in trance. Lord Shiva would have stood up out of etiquette, mm-hmm. but there was no necessity to. Daksha harbored an envy of Lord Shiva for a long time. If we're envious of someone, then eventually it will come out in words or actions. Therefore, one must curb one's envious nature. If one has envy towards another, then you must curb it. Otherwise, it will eventually come out. So, Daksha, he was envious of Shiva, and then eventually he cursed Lord Shiva and spoke very inappropriately to him. So then, after cursing Lord Shiva and speaking inappropriately to Lord Shiva, then there was cursing and counter-cursing by the followers of Lord Shiva, Nandishwara, and by Rigu Muni on behalf of the Brahmanas. So then the whole atmosphere became angry. And Prabhupada says we must be very careful not to create atmospheres of anger. Because when anger becomes prominent, then we'll say things and do things under the sway of the force of anger, which we would later regret. So this cursing and counter-cursing took place, and Lord Shiva was very disappointed by the whole thing, and he left silently. And then chapter 3 is called? Talks between Lord Shiva and Sati. So Sati saw that everyone in the universe was going to Daksha's second yajna. So she also wanted to attend. But then Lord Shiva advised her, it's better that we do not go, because your father has an envious mentality towards me, and he will criticize me. And this will cause you grief, and then you will give up your body. But as we see, Prabhupada comments at that point that because of her womanly nature, she wanted to attend the social setting of the yajna. And also, she felt that Prabhupada comments on the nature of a woman, that she wants to experience that kind of social dealing and so forth. So she was advised by Lord Shiva, do not go. But then in the beginning of chapter 4, which is called Satikutsa body, then she goes. But then Prabhupada explains, as we discussed last night, that her main purpose in going was not because she wanted to attend a social function, but her main purpose in going, she wanted to defend the personality of Lord Shiva, his exalted personality. So she wanted to go and speak to her father and try to explain to him and persuade him to offer respect for Lord Shiva. So she went, and that was her purpose. So Prabhupada actually glorifies her. In the context of the third chapter, Prabhupada said she should have been listening to her husband, and she should not have attended the yajna. But in the fourth chapter, then Prabhupada glorifies her and says this is the right course of action, that one should defend a Vaishnava or Krishna when they are being insulted or offended. So ultimately, that was her mentality or her motivation, was to defend Lord Shiva. So she attended the yajna. And last night, she saw that when she arrived at the yajna, she was not respected by Daksha because of her connection with Lord Shiva. So then she began to speak very heavily towards Daksha. And tonight she will continue to speak to him, and then she will quit her body. We'll do verses 19 through 27. Next week we'll finish the chapter. Okay, so we'll begin from text number 19.
Temple is called creation of the fourth order. What is it called?
Creation of the fourth order. Then the first chapter is called Sarga. First canto is called creation. Second canto, I think, is called secondary creation, isn't it? I think you looked at the beginning, I'm pretty sure it's in the end. Third one is planetary systems. What's the fourth one?
Creation of the fourth order.
Of the fourth order. That seems to be more like Monday's stuff. I'm not sure. Not sure. Maybe we can research it. If anyone can find out the answer, then please do.
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. So, 10 subject matters, and the 10th canto is called the Summer Bonum, which is Australia. And there's 9 cantos, so I expect, maybe, I don't know, 11 and 12 are called. I'm not sure.
What
happened?
What's
that?
Initially, talked about spiritual world, and the Lord expanding spiritual world.
And then the second order was not Brahma, the third order was Prajapati, and now the fourth order.
Coming below.
Could be. I'm not sure. We'll have to, maybe someone can research it. If you can find the answer, then.
Sorry, but can we
The fourth canto is called, see if you open the fourth canto, it is called the creation of the fourth order. So, canto one is called creation, I think, from memory, and canto two is called secondary creation, I think, which is Saga and Visakha. And then third canto, I can't remember what it's called, but fourth canto says creation of the fourth order. So we're just trying, because I know tenth canto is called Samam Bonam, like that, which is a Shraya, the tenth. So, not sure if Prabhupada's called each canto one of the, like that. So I'm not sure of that. So if anyone can find out, then please do. Okay, verse number 19. It is better to execute one's own occupational duty than to criticize others. Elevated transcendentalists may sometimes forego the rules and regulations of the Vedas, since they do not need to follow them, just as the demigods travel in space, whereas ordinary men travel on the surface of the earth. So Prabhupada points out within the purport that Lord Shiva is a very great personality. So we should follow Lord Shiva, we should not try to imitate him, because his position is beyond the modes of material nature. Daksha has taken Shiva to be an ordinary personality. He takes Lord Shiva to be a conditioned living entity, because he thinks that Lord Shiva is tamasic, because he is in control of the mode of ignorance. Therefore he's known as tamasi. So although he is tamasi, he is not tamasic. Right? Although he's in control of the mode of ignorance, he is not under the influence of the mode of ignorance. But Daksha thinks that he is under the mode of ignorance, and he thinks that I am a brahmana, I am in the mode of goodness. But actually he is under the influence of the mode of ignorance, because his consciousness is passionate and ignorant. But Lord Shiva, his consciousness is Vasudeva, which means it is spiritual. He is fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So he is not under the influence of the lower modes of nature. So therefore, Prabhupada points out in the purport, we must follow Lord Shiva, we cannot imitate. And we cannot put ash on our body and skulls on our neck and snakes and come to Bhakti Vai Bhav. You'll not get special marks for doing it. Like that. As much as you may like to imitate Shiva, no, you don't have qualification like Shiva. If we do that, we will come under the influence of Tamagun. Whereas Shiva, he may do that, but no effect of Tamagun, because he's absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So there's no effect. Now, the Prabhupada points out in the purport, if someone is obviously more advanced than us, but they may do something which we cannot understand, and we should not criticize them. Sometimes devotees who are more advanced than us, they may do things which we cannot necessarily understand. Just like sometimes in Kartik, when I go to India, then I stay at the ashram, Bhaktivedanta Ashram at Govardhan. Sometimes I stay there. So sometimes some of the senior devotees, one time I was giving a class there in the morning, and some of the younger brahmacharis are asking me, because there were different sannyasis staying there. It's an ashram, only for sannyasis and brahmacharis and men. No females stay there. So some of the devotees, younger devotees, were asking me, how do we understand that Prabhupada says we must go to Mangalati and chant his feet, all these things. But many of the sannyasis don't come from Mangalati and they don't do it. But I said to them that they're much more advanced than us, so you cannot judge them. We have to go to Mangalati. We have to, you know, we have to follow rule and regulation, because we're neophytes. But they're not neophytes, they're very advanced devotees. They have hundreds of disciples, thousands of disciples, and very powerful influence. Right? So we can tell they're very exalted persons. So if they do something different to us, then we cannot criticize them. So Prabhupada points this out in the purport. If you see an advanced devotee do something which looks a little different to what we would do, in terms of rules and regulations, you cannot criticize, because that will be an aparad. That will be an offense. Right? If you begin to criticize them, Maharaj doesn't go to Mangalati. Just like sometimes, like Prabhupada actually, Prabhupada would get up in the morning, like he'd stay up here in the darshan room, that was Prabhupada's bedroom, and then his bed's in his room now, which we have above us. His bed's there, but actually he slept in that room, the room next door. That's where he slept. But that was his translation room and where he'd take prasadam and like that. So Prabhupada would get up in the morning at 12:30 while all of us were sleeping, and Prabhupada would wash his hands, wash his mouth, and begin to translate the Bhagavatam. So someone could say, why Prabhupada didn't take full bath? Prabhupada wouldn't take bath till about 6 in the morning. That was his... So someone would say, well, that's tamasic. Yeah, it says in Shastra you should take bath when you rise. Right? But that's Prabhupada. Prabhupada's way above. Maybe we should take bath when we rise because we're tamasic. Like that. But Prabhupada is not. So if he does not do, then you cannot criticize. So you follow, you don't imitate. Prabhupada didn't go to Mangalati. Although he started ISKCON, he writes in his books that everyone in ISKCON must go to Mangalati. He didn't go to Mangalati. He did go to Mangalati, but when he was travelling around the world, he would be up in his room translating while the devotees went to Mangalati. Like that. So we cannot say, oh, Prabhupada didn't... No, you can't say like that. So if you criticise someone who's more advanced than you for doing something different, that is aparad, that is offence. So you have to be very careful like that. Don't fall into this mentality. It's due to one thing. What is that called?
Envy.
Yeah. I was thinking of a different thing. But it's true. Envy. It's due to pride. Because we're proud, and we think, you know, if you're proud, you can criticize someone who is above you. Like that. But then that causes havoc in your spiritual life. I've done this myself. You know, criticize someone who's more advanced than us and make some judgment on them. Right? But then it causes problems in your spiritual life. Right? Because you are thinking, because of your pride, then you judge them when they're far more advanced than you. That's not appropriate. Maybe. But you have to be very humble. Any questions or comments so far? Yeah, it says in the, I think, second chapter or third chapter, Prabhupada mentions that he becomes a little affected. But when he may get a little affected, but then he brings himself back to pure Krishna consciousness again. So there might be some slight adulteration. Because he's in contact with that mind, so some slight adulteration. It's not like he becomes overwhelmed by it. It's not like he gets into it and totally loses. Yeah, it's just like a slight thing which is there, then he comes back to Krishna consciousness. He's not like us. Yeah. Anything else?
No, is anywhere mentioned why Lord Shiva puts on this colours, ash and all that?
I'm not sure why. I think, as far as I understand, Prabhupada said because he wants to attract those who are lower, who are tamasic, so he dresses like that, and then he sits in the crematorium at midnight. Like we won't go to the crematorium at midnight, but he goes there at midnight and sits there with ash on him and everything, and then they all see him, all the ghosts and goblins, and they come over to him and go, who are you, what are you doing, and then you know, he sits there with them and then he purifies them by his association. So, like that. Any other points? In the Vedas, there are directions for two kinds of activities. Activities for those who are attached to material enjoyment and activities for those who are materially detached. In consideration of these two kinds of activities, there are two kinds of people who have different symptoms. If one wants to see two kinds of activities in one person, that is contradictory. But both kinds of activities may be neglected by a person who is transcendentally situated. So, sati uses the terms pravritti and nivritti. So, pravritti means like a grihastha, someone who has some material attachments but is purifying them by following Vedic injunctions. And one who is nivritti, she compares to being like a sannyasi, or one who is renounced and following the path of nivritti or renunciation, giving things up. But actually Shiva is on neither of those paths. Now, Lord Shiva is a pure devotee, he's a paramahamsa, therefore he's above both of those situations. He's not attached and he's not following rituals because he's purifying himself, even though he's a grihastha. He does not follow rituals to purify himself. He's above that. That's why he does things which are different. And he is not a sannyasi, even though he lives in renounced and all those things, but actually he's above all that. Just like we see the story later on in the Bhagavatam, that Chitraketu Maharaj is flying over in an aeroplane, a vimana, and he looks down and he sees Lord Shiva is giving Bhagavatam class and Parvati is sitting on his lap. Yeah? So he smiles because he thinks that's very interesting, that you'd sit in the Bhagavatam class with your wife on your lap. This is like a very strange thing. But the sages and rishis who were listening to Lord Shiva speak, it was not unnatural, because she is Durga, she's the personification of the material energy, and she's sitting there and he's completely in a state of Vasudeva consciousness or pure Krishna consciousness, and so is she, so there's nothing unnatural. But Chitraketu Maharaj, he thought it was a little humorous, so he smiled. But then Sati looked up and she cursed him. She said, like that. So then there was a curse put upon Chitraketu, like that. So, the point is that Lord Shiva is not bound. He's not nivritti, he's not pravritti. Even though he may be appear to be one thing or another thing, renounced or in grihastha life, but he's beyond both. He's completely on the transcendental platform. That's the way he must be seen and understood. Any points?
Yeah,
so therefore the teaching is follow, don't imitate. You follow, but you don't imitate. That's the instruction he's given. Shiva can do so many things, but he is in Vasudeva consciousness. When we're in Vasudeva consciousness, then maybe we can do something. Yeah, I understand your point, but that's the point. That's how you understand it. Because the acharyas teach that point. So it's not just their example, it's their teaching also. Like that. And most of them don't do it. It's only Lord Shiva who does. But Lord Shiva is Lord Shiva. So.
It was mentioned that
It's in this purport, Prabhupada explains it like that. But in that previous purport, earlier, I think in the third canto, then Prabhupada explains it as you're saying, like that. So that's the way we understand it, the way Prabhupada explained it previously. But in this purport, he makes it like that. You have to speak up. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would worship Shiva when he travelled through South India, because Swami's write prayers to Lord Shiva through Gopeshwara Mahadev.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions, worship of Shiva. Prabhupada is mentioning here Vaishnavanamrita, so his position is clear. Prabhupada may have given us like a basic sadhana, but then under the direction of our guru, we may add further things from our Gaudiya tradition to that with the blessings of our guru. You don't add anything whimsically. And just like in Kartik, then I chant Ashtika to Brinda Devi, because Jagatrini Manaji, she gave me that instruction many, many years ago. She said you should chant prayers to Brinda Devi, Tulsi Devi, Tulsi Maharaj, special prayers to Brinda. So I chant, so then I wrote to my Guru Maharaj, to my Krishna Goswami. I said, Mataji has given me this instruction, may I follow it? He said, yes, you may follow it. So then Kartik I chant, different Ashtikas like that. So then this is not what Prabhupada did not get that. Right? But then, in our Gaudiya tradition, there are so many things. So then we can add that with the blessings of our guru. Okay. Anything else?
Okay. My dear father, the opulence we possess is impossible for either of you or your flatterers to imagine. For persons who engage in fruitive activities by performing great sacrifices are concerned with satisfying their bodily necessities by eating food, by eating foodstuff offered as sacrifice. We can exhibit our opulences simply by desiring to do so. This can be achieved only by great personalities who are renounced, self-realized souls. So Prabhupada points out in the first paragraph that Lord Shiva's opulence, it may be difficult for materialistic people to detect because of his being materially bereft. In other words, because he looks so simple, you know, he lives under a tree and he is acting in the way he acts, with his vesh, the way he appears, that people may mistake him and misunderstand his greatness. So therefore they take him for granted or they offer disrespect to him. Rupa Goswami, in the Nectar of Devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he gives 64 offences to be avoided. Right? Now, one of those offences is to disrespect the devatas, the demigods. It's actually an aparadha. It actually is an offence to bhakti, because the devatas are Vaishnavas, they're devotees, they're not something different, they're actually devotees. So sometimes we hear in classes, like sometimes devotees will minimize the demigods, oh Indra did that, and Brahma did that, and Shiva is like this, and you know, devotees will speak like that. But if you put yourself next to Indra, or you know, what to speak of Brahma and Shiva, you know, we're probably not as advanced as they are at this point in time. Yeah, Lord Indra is not a neophyte devotee. He's a very advanced devotee. So it is an offence, Rupa Goswami says, and it is an offence to Krishna, because they're his servants. They're his empowered representatives. It's an offence to Krishna to minimise their position. And especially when you're dealing with Mahadev, Lord Shiva himself, who is a partial representation of Krishna himself, he's almost God himself, you have to be very careful how you deal with him. You know, sometimes, you know, devotees, you know, when they're not so mature, they'll say, oh, I love Shiva and like that and like that. We only worship Vishnu and Krishna. No, yeah, but you have to understand their position, their consciousness like that. So you be very careful how we deal. So sometimes people, they think, oh, Shiva is just materially bereft. He lives under a tree and he has skulls and bones and, you know. You don't understand how powerful he is. Just like there's that story in the Mahabharata where Indra was one time walking next to one of the heavenly rivers, and he saw there were golden lotus flowers floating down the river. Right? Lotuses made of gold, pure gold. So he thought that is very peculiar. So he walked further up the river, and when he came up the river, he saw there was a boy sitting there surrounded by a number of young girls, and they were playing dice, like rolling and playing, just playing a game. They were laughing and playing. And this beautiful golden young boy, from his eyes, there were tears dropping. And as the tears dropped into the river, and fell into the river, they turned into a golden lotus flower and then floated down the river. So Indra thought, who is this boy? So Indra said, I am Indra, king of heaven. He said, who are you? And the boy didn't even look at him. And the boy was just playing and just rolling the dice with the girls, and they were all laughing and playing. So then Indra stepped forward and he said, who are you? I am Indra. And as he came forward, the boy looked at him. And when the boy looked at him, Indra became frozen. He couldn't even move. Imagine someone so powerful, they just look at you and you just, you can't even move. And then he looked at him and he said, my name is Shiva. Now he took on he had this particular form and he was enjoying this particular lila. Mm-hmm. He said, my name is Shiva. And Indra was like, and then he let him go. So that is the point. We don't understand how powerful Shiva is. He's practically God himself. And his original form, he is God himself. As Sadashiva, he is God, he's Vishnu. But then he just becomes slightly affected by the material energy, by Durga, his wife. So then he's like, but actually he's all-powerful. Which is that we have to offer him all respect. That's the point. Okay. Now, Prabhupada says in the second paragraph that sometimes the worshippers of demigods, they offer bhoga to the devas, just like sometimes you go to India and they do all these pujas, Kali puja and all these different pujas, and they offer bhoga to the devas, or they might even offer it to Vishnu, but it's all about devas of worship, and the whole thing is contaminated, the consciousness is contaminated, it's not pure. So we should not take that kind of prasad. We don't take that. We don't take Deva Prasad. We don't take, even when it's the jagya is not for the pleasure of Krishna or Vishnu, we don't take the, even if it's a Devita jagya and they offer the bhoga to Vishnu eventually, but it's not, the mood is not right. We don't take that. The only bhoga we take is the bhoga which is offered to Krishna, which is then transformed into prasad by Krishna's mercy. Then we take the remnants of Krishna, which is, in other words, the offering must be done directly for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna is not like some secondary personality or indirectly it's offered to him. Right? It has to be directly offered to him for his pleasure. So whenever we cook an offering for the deities, it is only for their pleasure. Idam Krishnaya, idam na mama. It's not for us. Right? We don't think it's for this one or that one. No, it's for Krishna. And when Krishna is satisfied, then. It's like sometimes devotees say, I've heard people ask, even before the offering comes out of the kitchen, oh, what's on the offering? What are we offering Krishna? It's none of your business what Krishna is eating. When Krishna is finished and whatever's left, if he leaves anything, then you can have it. Now, if he doesn't leave anything, then you go hungry. Now, but he's very merciful. He takes it and he leaves it. Right? And if he leaves anything, then we take that. That's prasad. Right? And we honour prasad. Now, we're not vultures. We don't all just swarm into the kitchen before Krishna's plate is even washed and begin to... You don't even touch Krishna's prasad until his plate is washed. It's not respecting Krishna. You should be worried about washing Krishna's plate, not how many pieces of pizza you're going to get. If you remember then, you can ask. I can't remember. Something about Lord Shiva. Anyway, you remember, you can ask. We're here for another 40 minutes.
There are well known shrines of Lord Shiva in India.
Yeah, it doesn't please Shiva.
We're devotees, right? So do we ever take anything which is not offered to Krishna? Right? So why would Shiva take something that's not offered to Krishna? And Nandagram, that is the system. They offer to Krishna Balaram, then they take out to Shiva, and then they offer. That's the system. That's what pleases Shiva.
That's not the good thing.
Yeah, but they're not Vaishnavas. They're Shaivites. Prabhupada says the Shaivites and the Vaishnavas have been arguing for a long time. Okay. But Vishnu is supreme. That is the... final Siddhanta of the Vedas. Krishna is to Bhagavan Swayam. So Shiva is Krishna's servant. Like that. So we see him. We offer him all respect as Krishna's servant. Like that. So then we have to, if we understand his mood, what pleases him? We understand what pleases him. By the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Prabhupada, we understand what pleases him. So that's how we have to respect him and offer. Good. Yeah, they offer meat to Kali, and Kali gives it to the Buddhas. They come and eat it all. So you just eat Buddha Prasad. So. Buddha Prasad. Okay. So, the third paragraph, Srila Prabhupada says, that it is seen that often the worshippers of Shiva are very rich. This is explained by Prabhupada in the 10th canto of the Bhagavad Gita. Because the followers of Shiva, because Sati or Parvati is the goddess of the material energy, so she can give so much opulence, because she has control of the material energy. Whereas the Vaishnavas, they are seen to be quite poor quite often, because Krishna is known as Hari. Hari means one who takes everything away. Hari is the name of a lion. One of the names of a lion is Hari, one who takes everything away. Because when the lion wants to take everything away, there's not much argument. It's just you have whatever you want. I'm going and I'll come back later. So that is what Krishna is like. When Krishna, that's the way he deals with his devotees. You see, if devotees have material attachments or desires, then Krishna takes those things. Because he's Hari, he takes it like that. So if you try to hold on to your material attachments or your material desires, that is not possible. If you follow Krishna. Because Krishna will not allow that. Krishna will take those things away and he will give himself. Like that. That's Krishna's nature. Like that. But Lord Shiva, he is Ashutosh, so he's easily pleased. So if you want something material, then he'll say, okay, have it. No problem. If that's what you want, then take it. But if you worship Krishna, then the mood is different. Krishna's desires are different. Krishna deals with his devotees very differently to the way Lord Shiva deals. So why does Lord Shiva offer material benedictions to people? Because he is keeping the Vaishnava sampradayas pure. Because otherwise all the... as the Sri Prabhu was explaining before, because otherwise all the materialists would come into the Vaishnava sampradayas and they would be asking for all material things from Vishnu. So Lord Shiva does that service on behalf of the Lord. Then people who want material things, they come to Shiva and they say, please give me material. He says, okay, have that. Okay. But those who are more serious, who want transcendental goals, then they worship Lord Vishnu, they worship Krishna, and they get those desires fulfilled. Yeah, we should, even if we have material desires, we should worship Krishna. But if you have material desires, Krishna will take them away. Whereas if you worship Lord Shiva with material desires, he may increase your material facility. Like that, so. Okay. You are an offender at the lotus feet of Lord Shiva. And unfortunately, I have a body produced from yours. I am very much ashamed of our bodily relationship. And I condemn myself because of my body being is contaminated by a relationship with a person who is an offender at the lotus feet of the greatest personality. Some of the comments in this section are that she changed her, like, it's like she changed the material body. But it's like when a material body is used in the service of the Lord, it's not material like that. Just like you'll see with Prabhupada, then we can say that Prabhupada had like a material form. But it's not a material form. Because it's purely used in the service of Krishna. So there has been some comments in this section where it says that she changed a material body. But it's not a material body. If it's like that, it's not a material body. So, Krishna is realized by someone who is on the platform of Shuddha Sattva. He cannot be realized otherwise. Krishna can only be realized when we come to the mode of pure goodness. So Lord Shiva has realized the Supreme Personality of Godhead because his consciousness is Vasudev. Vasudev means Shuddha Sattva. Vasudev, or Krishna, is born from Vasudev. Krishna's father is Vasudev. Vasudev means pure goodness, Shuddha Sattva. So that means that Krishna is born from pure goodness. When you're in pure goodness, you will realize Krishna. So, the Lord Shiva has this type of consciousness. Now, we should not tolerate blasphemy of devotees. Like that. So we made this point last night very strongly. So, there are six ways that we can offend devotees. This is from the Skanda Purana. So the first one is
to not feel joy upon seeing a devotee. Right? It's actually an aparad, it's an offense. It may be like a small offense, but it's an offense, it's an aparad. It means not to smile. When you see a devotee and you don't become happy when you see the devotee, that's an offense. The devotee may feel hurt by that. Just like sometimes, you know, you see a devotee and then you kind of look away or look down or your face is not happy. Mm-hmm. And then the devotee may feel some pain. So then that is some offense. So we have to be careful with that. Then, more serious is to fail to offer respect or obeisances to a devotee. So you see a devotee, you know, especially if you haven't seen a devotee for a long time, then we offer obeisances like that. We offer respect, pranam, right? We offer respects to devotees. It says that when you see a sannyasi, when you see him, for the first time that day, you have to offer obeisances. And then, when he sees you for the first time that day, you have to offer obeisances. So if you see Sadhu Swami simultaneously, you offer obeisances. Otherwise, if you walk into the courtyard and Ramai Swami is there, then you offer obeisances. And then, you're walking across the courtyard and then he turns around and looks at you, then you offer obeisances. So when you see him and he sees you for the first time, that is the etiquette. So who is sannyasi? Yeah, not a sannyasi. You lose your pious credits if you don't offer obeisances to a sannyasi when you see him.
Because yeah. What about the non-devotees, if they don't know that?
Non-devotees, everything they do is inauspicious. It's not much. So, we must offer respect to devotees. It means if a devotee comes to your home, you have to offer some respect. Someone comes to your home, you have to offer them, would you like a glass of water? Would you like somewhere to sit? You know, some nice words like that. Someone comes to your home, you have to offer some respect like that, and obeisances. So this is one of it. Then, more disrespectful is to become angry at the devotee. As you said, the only devotee who can become angry with us is our senior. A senior devotee can become a little bit angry if he wants. That's his prerogative. We have to tolerate our seniors. If sometimes they chastise us, then we're tolerant. We don't offer argument or we don't take offense to that. But with other devotees, then we have to be very careful. We don't, our equals or our superiors, then we do not, or even our juniors in general, we do not become angry with the devotees, because it's an apparat. Because then it creates some ill feeling in their heart, and then it's not pleasant. Then, to envy of the devotees, this can mean so many things. This can just be in the mind. But it's an apparat, because as we said before, it'll come out eventually. If you keep envying the devotees, you're envying the devotees, then eventually it comes out words or speech or activities. So it will come out. So therefore, one should not envy the devotees. This can be many, many things. Because it means mental offences, right? Verbal offences, and then physical offences. All these things can be done. Okay. And then, more serious is the blaspheme of the devotee. Right? So to envy the devotee, that might just be in the mind, but blaspheme the devotee means without speech. And we spoke about that at the last night. Very dangerous and very common. So we have to be very careful. And the worst is to kill a devotee, or this can mean even just to physically harm a devotee. You know, one time, I've seen it happen. Like that. Yeah, the devotee will physically hit another devotee. It's not involved. This is very bad. It means that devotee who physically harms another devotee in the spiritual life will be very problematic for a long time. Unless he one time, Madhava Maharaj was telling that one devotee, one ISKCON devotee, went to Vrindavan, and the rickshawwala was like harassing him, and then he became angry and he hit him. And then he didn't come back to Vrindavan for 14 years. Krishna kicked him out. That's very serious. The Brijvasis are, anyone you go to the Holy Dharma, anyone in the Holy Dharma, they're special, they're devotees. So be very careful how you deal with that. People in the Holy Dharma are not ordinary. And then the worst is to kill a devotee. Please don't do that. Because if you do that, I will fail you for the rest of the course. I don't care how many times, I don't care how many full life jumps you give me.
Very few years from now and then, normally you go to the first meeting and you see the Vrijvasis, the number of provinces, and there are so many moving around. And we have to really respect for that and how to get in the future. How do you reconcile that with the perception?
The main thing is, what is your consciousness? Yeah, consciousness, what is your heart? That's the main thing. It means that whenever you see a devotee, in your heart you should feel happy. Not that. But there's no loss to offer obeisances. Sachinandan Swami last year in Kartik, he spent Kartik in Varshana, right around his home, chanting 64 rounds a day and doing other services. So he told us that Radhanath Swami came to visit him. And he said that when he was there in Varshana, when Radhanath Swami came to see Sachinandan Swami, they went on some parikram. And he said that Radhanath Swami was offering obeisances to the cows, right, to the little Brijvasi children, maybe to the peacocks, maybe to the monkeys.
about, he said he was offering obeisances to many of the living entities in the Dham, the trees, the roots of the trees in the Dham, the roots of the trees are the lotus feet of the trees. So you put your, whenever you see the Kalpa Vrikshas, the trees in the holy Dham, you put your head on their feet, you make advancement by offering obeisances to their roots, their feet. So the most important thing is to have that loving mood. But then, if you offer obeisances, then that's wonderful.
Also, as soon as you we arrive at Vrindavan, the first time is to step in the first operation.
And roll in the dust.
We don't mind, but I saw you the other day, you were pushing the devotees for the darshan time. So, was that right according to Vaishnava etiquette?
I wasn't trying to push them, I was trying to move them, because they were the men were standing in the way of the Mataji's at darshan time.
But the deities were not running away.
The deities were.
Because not running away. Everybody takes some time to do the darshan.
Yeah.
So if somebody is doing the darshan and you're pushing them away,
yeah.
Is that the right idea?
I think that most of the devotees, because as far as I understand, from what I saw on that morning, then there was the habit of the men to block the women. So I wasn't pushing, I wasn't physically. I moved the devotees with my hands.
But men don't even know that they're blocking the view of the...
Then that's their ignorance. That's why I was moving the men.
But once they have taken darshan, they will obviously move to the next, and then women can obviously see the darshan.
Well,
there's
one of the women.
Yeah.
I've heard from many, many Matajis.
Especially on festival days, so
yeah,
many
men
to see the
faces.
They should understand
that
even women
want.
No, but just the
darshan. So basically, I think my point was correct. I think it's correct because I was acting on behalf of the Matajis who have told me many occasions. And the men don't. The men think they're the only ones in the temple.
But Prabhu, the darshan just opened and you were pushing all of them away.
Yeah, because all the men were blocking the women. The women couldn't even see the deities. It wasn't even respectful to the women. Where's the respect to the other devotees? If you're standing in the temple having darshan and you don't understand there's anyone else behind you, you think it's only you seeing Krishna.
But you didn't even let the Prabhu take the darshan.
Okay, well I disagree. If you think that I did the wrong thing, then I accept that. I don't mind. If you think I did the wrong thing, I accept that. But as far as I can see, most of the men moved when I physically moved them because I couldn't walk down the line saying, excuse me, Prabhu, excuse me, Prabhu. I just physically moved them. I didn't push them hard.
I think that's the right thing.
Could be.
To ask somebody without touching them.
Could be. If you feel like that, I accept that. Yeah, but I don't think the other men minded. When a more senior devotee corrects you, then you should be humble, then you should take that. Okay. That should be the etiquette. And I didn't see most of the men minded. I think they understood what I was doing. But I didn't push them hard. I was just moving them like that. So I could have been wrong, but I don't think I was. Any other point?
We were just talking about the settings that during major festivals and all that, I think it's the right thing to actually get everyone to take darshan, which is what Nirudha Prabhu actually asked us to actually move everyone because people were waiting outside. It's always sometimes if we do offend devotees, we are actually doing our duty in order to get everyone to take darshan. And suppose in a major festival like the Gautamino, we have to do such a thing even though we may be offending. You have to sort of give everyone a chance.
Yes, the point is it should be done nicely. Because I've seen sometimes on Jamaster meet like the midnight, like they're just pushing everyone through like cattle.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really the mood. Everyone should at least have a few moments to nicely. I mean, you ask them, please move, but not like physically just pushing them.
I heard one of the lectures by the Guru Maharaj that whenever a Shastric point is told by a senior devotee, there are two approaches we can take. We can see how those Shastric rules are applicable to all, everyone else around us. Or we can also see how they are applicable to us. And he said that the latter approach is not recommended. that when a senior devotee tells us some Shastric points, then we see how it is applicable to us, rather than thinking that how all others should be just vis-a-vis those particular principles. Then we progress in spiritual life. Otherwise, we may just be correct. And being correct will not cure the entry into spiritual world. Because spiritual world is beyond correct and wrong.
Yeah, so humility is the primary quality of the Vaishnavas. We must accept the instruction of our seniors. That's how we advance in Krishna consciousness. Okay. Which verse are we up to?
Okay.
Because of our family relationship, when Lord Shiva addresses me as Dakshayani, I at once become morose, and my jolliness and my smile at once disappear. I feel very much sorry that my body, which is just like a bag, has been produced by you. I shall, therefore, give it up. So normally, we don't commit suicide when we get offended by a devotee. Yeah, normally, that's not our course of action. But sometimes, there are these incidents are there within the Shastra to emphasize to us the importance of the point. Just like when Gandhari found out she was going to marry Sri Tarastra, then she blindfolded herself. Now why did she do that? That was very extreme in one sense. You know, she's had to spend the entire life without vision. Why did she do it? Because she's showing how chaste a wife should be to the husband. She's one of the seven most chaste women like that. So this is the instruction. They show extreme points to make an extreme point to us. So Sati is committing suicide. Why is she doing that? Because she's making an extreme point to us. Right? Because the main point in this section of the Bhagavad Gita is we should not offend Vaishnavas. So it is not that we will necessarily follow. None of us will follow. None of us will. You know, most likely will not happen. We'll have to follow this level of. But the point is being made. Right? Do not offend Vaishnavas. That's how seriously she took it. You offended Shiva. You don't understand his position. I don't want anything to do with you. You know, if this body is connected to you, I'd rather give it up. So then, she gave up the body. What was that?
You start talking normally, you don't commit suicide, and then you don't think I didn't understand. I start writing what you're going to say, and you didn't get the point.
Yeah, it means
normally
that
we do not commit suicide when we are offended by devotees?
Yeah, because the main point of this section is that we should not offend devotees. So Sati was showing, she shows how serious Vaishnava aparat is. That's why...
Because someone can commit suicide?
Yeah, because she committed suicide to show us how intolerant she was of the aparat Shiva.
Okay.
So that's why she committed suicide. So not that we will do that, but the point is we have to become very intolerant of Vaishnava aparat. You know, whenever we hear Vaishnava aparat, then we should not tolerate it. It's wrong. It's detrimental. And it destroys the culture of bhakti, like that. Because within ISKCON now, the most successful temple, which is commonly judged by many devotees, and many senior devotees in ISKCON, is Chaupati. Seem to be like the now. What is the one of the principal reasons of the success is because there is not Vaishnava aparat, because the devotees are so trained in etiquette and respect and loving dealings between each other. There is not opportunity to commit aparat. Right? So then, if you go there, there's not like there's no mood of aparat. It's not like, you know, one devotee has got some problem with another devotee. Most temples you go to, there will be some, you know, rifts or conflicts or long-standing kind of disputes between certain members like that, but it's not there. It should not be there. It should not be there within ISKCON even. Anywhere like that. But, you know, one devotee will not talk to this devotee and not talk to that devotee. And, you know, you took the last avocado from me in 1983. You know, I'll not talk to you ever again. Like that. So, such petty things. Sometimes you hear what devotees are fighting about. It's such a petty thing, you know, so insignificant. Oh, how come you're not talking to that Mataji? Oh, because, you know, you just think, you know, very strange. We get so offended by such insignificant things. Okay. And we have to be very careful that ISKCON is a spiritual movement. Sometimes devotees, I've been to temples in the past, I don't know what it's like now, I've been to temples where like the devotees from South India do not talk from the devotees from North India within the temple. So, you know, why did you join ISKCON? Why don't you just go down to the Shiva Vishnu temple and, you know, well, you know, they probably don't even do that down there. You know, and then some places in ISKCON, like all this bodily concept and all this apara takes place because of the body. And you know, I went to one temple many years ago and they said, oh, I was only there for a few days, but they said, oh, the South Indian devotees don't talk to the North Indian devotees. You know, what's the problem?
Could have been language barrier.
Yeah, could have been. So you're following the teachings of the Bhagavatam, you're only seeing the good.
Same language.
Yeah. Good to think like that. Okay. Maitreya, the sage, told Vidura, O annihilator of enemies, while thus speaking to her father in the arena of sacrifice, Sati sat down on the ground and faced north. Dressed in saffron garments, she sanctified herself with water and closed her eyes to absorb herself in the process of mystic yoga. So, the purpose of yoga, Prabhupada points out in the purport, that the purpose of yoga is to free oneself from the entanglement of the bodily conception of life. Now, these days, people do yoga to increase their attachment to the bodily concept of life. So it's not yoga, right? Because that's not the purpose. These days, people only do asana. Right? Because there are eight steps in yoga. Right? Yama, niyama, asana. So they get to asana, right? Some practically go to pratyahara. Pranayama. That's practically as far as it goes. You go down to most of the yoga schools, so they go to asana, pranayama, bus. Like that. So then the whole thing just becomes increasing the bodily concept of life. You know, if I have a healthier body, I can have better sex. Yeah, that's basically where it finishes. Right? That's basically what yoga is these days. So it's not what yoga is about. Yoga is to free you from the bodily concept of life. Right? You get to pranayama, then pratyahara, then dharana, then dhyana, then samadhi. Right? That is the eighth process of yoga, to become free from the bodily concept of life. So Prabhupada points out in the purport that that is the purpose of yoga. So that's what Sati did. She used yoga to free herself from the body. Right? She raised the soul up to the top of the head. Right, and then combusted the body, set it on fire, the body destroyed, and her soul, she took it to another body. And she became the daughter of Himalayas. Right, daughter of the Himalaya mountains, right, Parvati. She married Shiva again. Right, I'll stay the wife of Shiva, but not in this body, because it's connected to Daksha, so get rid of it. So that's the point of yoga, right? So that you can free yourself from the bodily concept of life. Now, Prabhupada points out in this section, it's not possible these days. Ashtanga Yoga does not work in Kali Yuga. Right? It's not possible. Right? We do a little bit of yoga for health. A little bit. Yeah, I do a little bit every day for health. Pure silence, like that. That's it. That's as far as it goes. You know, you're not going to get Krishna consciousness by Ashtanga Yoga in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, it's only Bhakti Yoga which works. And of all the elements of Bhakti Yoga, it is Harinam Sankirtanam. Harinam Anukirtanam. As the Bhagavatam teaches, this is the only process in Kali Yuga which has potency. So this is what we follow in Kali Yuga. And all the other things are not necessary.
What's the significance of facing north?
I'm not sure. Does anyone know? Okay. Why does she face north?
Auspicious
to face
not the desires of Uttarayana,
Mohan,
and
Prabhupada.
Any more speculation?
How is it to make you then suffer though? She's a married lady, they won't be a suffering. I mean, if they're married and then, so.
You should not find faults in the Vaishnavas. Prabhupada mentions in the purport. Prabhupada explains the purport. In other words, she was renouncing. Right? Why do you put on saffron? Because I'm renounced of that. So, you're right, Mataji's don't normally do it, but her husband was not present and she was focused, so for some reason she did. Okay. Everyone quieten down so we can hear the question.
So the ordinary Vrindavan, and then head step in the normal direction, so there is facing south. South is basically in the direction of Yama. And the Yamabhutas come, they will take the soul. And then the yogis start, they know that they are not going to take the action of Yamabhutas. They can go face south, they will be very strong.
So it means when the ordinary people die, then they face their heads towards the south? Because the... Is it? Let's do this quickly because we don't have much time. Head is north. Ordinary people? But then you said the yogis... Ordinary people. Their head. So it could be something like that. Okay. Well, it sounds reasonable. I don't know, so it sounds reasonable. Okay. What's that? Yeah. First of all, she sat in a required sitting posture. And then she carried the life air upwards and placed it in the position of equilibrium near the navel. Then she raised her life air, mixed with intelligence, to the heart and then gradually towards the pulmonary passage and from there to between her eyebrows. So Prabhupada points out in the purport that in yoga, the reason they do asana and pranayama is because the body must be fit and healthy if you want to perfect your yoga practice. Because it takes many, many years to become a perfect yogi. So if you want to become perfect as a yogi, then you must practice with a very fit and healthy body. That's why they do the yoga like that. So what it means for us as devotees, it means as devotees we must look after our physical health. Because if you don't look after your physical health, you may have problems in your old age practicing bhakti like that. So we have to spend some time looking after our health. Just like when I'm at the farm, you know, in the mornings, most mornings I go for a run or a walk. Walk means like a very vigorous walk, and you know, or going for a run, but I hurt my knee so I can't run at the moment. But the point is, something has to be there. You have to keep yourself fit and healthy, because when you get old you want to be able to practice bhakti still. And if your body is all problematic, then it would be very hard for you to do your bhakti. So it is not maya to look after your body in a balanced fashion. You know, maybe 1 hour a day, 2 hours a day might be too much, but at least something, you know, 20 minutes exercise, half an hour exercise a day, should be doing something. Thus, in order to give up her body, which had been so respectfully and affectionately seated on the lap of Lord Shiva, who is worshipped by great sages and saints, Sati, due to anger towards her father, began to meditate on the fiery air within the body. So Prabhupada says in the purport that she committed suicide because she did not want to associate with Daksha anymore. Because Daksha was a materialist. And materialistic people are attached to sex life. So Prabhupada points out in the purport, as the Bhagavatam explains, materialistic people, because they're attached to sex life, that is their basis, then they lose all their good qualities. And by their association, we'll also lose our good qualities. So therefore, we should only associate with Mahatmas, with Mahajans, with great souls. And by their association, our consciousness will become elevated. If you associate with non-devotees, your consciousness will become degraded. But if you associate with the devotees, your consciousness becomes more elevated. So she had no interest to associate with non-devotees anymore, so she gave up her body. Okay. So she would not have any improper association. And the final verse for tonight. Sati concentrated all her meditation on the holy lotus feet of her husband, Lord Shiva, who is the supreme spiritual master of all the world. Thus she became completely cleansed of all taints of sin and quit her body in a blazing fire by meditation on the fiery elements. So Prabhupada points out in the purport, he makes a very wonderful comment that one should, I'll find Prabhupada's. Prabhupada says in the near the end of the first paragraph on page 156 in this book, he says, simply by chanting the holy name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, simply by remembering the lotus feet of Krishna, simply by offering prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is immediately freed from material contamination. The material bodily concept by the blazing fire of ecstasy. So, as Prabhupada points out in the purport, we have to destroy all of our connection to our body, to our material body. That's what Sati did. She destroyed any connection to the material body. Because the material body was only causing her problems. Because she was connected to Daksha. So she said, I do not want this anymore, so she physically burnt it. So Prabhupada says that we should destroy any of the connections we have to this material body, means our material attachments. And how do we do that? By the fire of spiritual ecstasy, Prabhupada says, in the purport. Very wonderful analogy. That by spiritual ecstasy, we become so absorbed in Krishna consciousness, so much absorbed in Krishna, that we just lose all our material attachments. Everything becomes burnt away. The body might still be there, but no material desire there. Like that. So this is the process. Cheto, Dapana, Marjanam, Bhava Maha, Devagni, Nibarpanam. Krishna consciousness destroys the blazing fire, destroys all of your material attachments. So we have to absorb ourselves in the fire of Krishna consciousness. Then all of our material attachments will become destroyed. So we'll stop there for tonight. So next Monday we will finish this chapter and then we'll begin chapter 5. Your examination will be at the end of chapter 7. So it must only be 3 weeks away or something like that. So get ready. All right, this way. I'll answer at the end of the class. We'll speak properly. Okay. Srila Prabhupada.